I'd like now to welcome to the cafe Jeffrey Rubin and Emma Sokoloff Rubin. Jeff is a professor of history at Boston University. Emma is a journalist and reporter for Gotham Schools in New York City, and they are co-authors of the new book, Sustaining Activism, a Brazilian Women's Movement and a Father-Daughter Collaboration. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us. We're thrilled
Thanks.
To be here.
It's great to be here.
So the two of you were kind of unlikely co-authors of this book because Emma was 12 when she first went to Brazil with you, and then 15 when you went back together. Jeff, you were studying social change movements there. How did you come to actually collaborate on this book?
Well, you know, I've always been really fascinated by various social movements, by the ways in which ordinary people in difficult circumstances can organize together and sometimes amazingly, unexpectedly, completely change the world around them. This happened in Brazil in the 1980s, when social movements across the country overthrew the military dictatorship that had been ruling for 20 years. Well, in 2001, I got funding to go to southern Brazil for a year, to a region where many of these movements had formed. I wanted to learn how they'd gotten started, how they took on the military and the police, and how they kept going. How do you do that kind of activism? You know, I want to know what's it like from the inside, when it might be really painful or scary. So I brought my family with me to Brazil for a year. And when I started going into the countryside and interviewing activists, I took my teenage daughter, Emma, with me. It was kind of a whim. You want to come along? And what happened was that Emma made an immediate, visceral connection to the women activists she met. And in some ways, it bypassed me. Something about what these women had done, taken on their government and their families, insisting on rights and a voice for women, and the way they'd stuck to that for over 20 years, that drew Emma in. So that's when we began a collaborative project, going back several times, you know, to figure out for ourselves, you know, what was so powerful about these women and how they'd created really a new place for themselves in the world. And that's something we set out to do together.
One of the things that I found sort of interesting and amusing was after a short time of being in Brazil, and Emma, you spoke Portuguese because you'd already been there, it turned out at the end of the day, Emma was the one who was furiously typing up all the notes, and Jeff was kind of looking out the window, even though you were the professor. And it turns out that those roles of who's doing what really weren't firmly established until you kind of made them up for yourselves.
That's absolutely right. You know, when we first started this research project together, it seemed that the roles would be clear-cut, that my dad would do the academic analysis and that I would kind of translate what he was saying for a student audience or for a more popular audience. And we imagined that kind of he would know what he was doing out in the field doing ethnography and I would just be following along. And what happened was, just as you said, that those roles got mixed up pretty much from the beginning. I certainly learned from him that one of the things you do when you come home from a day of field research is start taking notes. And then what happened is I had so much I wanted to write about and so much I wanted to say that at times he would say, okay, well, you do that and I'll go do something else.
And I also learned that unexpectedly, there were things that I could learn from my daughter that were supposed to be the things I did. So we'd sit down at our two computers at the end of the day, and we'd both be looking out the window and writing, and I would think and write a bit, and Emma was just tearing through, you know, writing away, typing, getting ideas. And so I said, okay, it's time for me to make dinner. So it just evolved in the moment. We never knew who was going to do what in advance, and we were kind of making up a new set of roles for ourselves, just as we were getting to know women who were forging new roles for themselves and their families.
And I think I'll just add that the back and forth nature of our project, the conversations between us and the shifting roles, the different things that each of us is noticing at different times, has been one of the most exciting parts of the project. That in the very beginning, when we went to a women's movement meeting, my dad was likely to come out with an analysis of the speeches that were given, and I was likely to have something to say about who moved where in the room and which leaders seemed able to bring together two groups that sat on opposite sides of the room, or what we could learn from the way people were speaking in addition to what they were saying. And then over time, we each learned from the other so that now if we go to a meeting together, I'm as likely to be talking about what was said and did you notice this and how did that compare to the last meeting and how do we understand this rhetoric? And my dad's as likely to say, did you notice what happened by the door this morning? So there's a back and forth that both of our, I think, cause since starting this collaborative project together, we have both done our own independent research projects, and I certainly feel that the research we did together shapes how I do research on my own.
So, southern Brazil the place where you did your work is such an interesting place because it's a rural place with, in some ways, very traditional values, and yet these women stood up to the military. Well, this whole, I mean, men and women stood up to the military dictatorship. And then as you write in the book, the 1980s were kind of like our 1960s, where people were going through their sense of freedom and how they wanted their lives to be. And it turns out that things like unions and pensions were a lot easier to achieve in some ways than who does the dishes and what is the distribution of work inside the household.
That was surprising for me to learn, that I imagined when I first started learning about the trajectories of these activists in southern Brazil that the hardest thing was staring down police, that the hardest thing was mobilizing under dictatorship to overthrow the dictatorship and then taking over government buildings, camping outside the governor's office door until he agreed to meet with women in the women's movement. What I learned over several years of interviews with these activists is that sometimes what's hardest to change is your own home, that it's a big deal to take a bus to the capital city of Brazil and protest, but then you leave. And so if you anger the governor, that's kind of a safe thing to do. That's part of politics. That's part of the rough and tumble of activism and of civil disobedience. But if you're asking your husband to do the dishes in a community where that's simply never been done, where that is not the expectation that he had growing up of what his role in the family would look like, and you live with this person and you share a family and a farm, that's a lot more both threatening and empowering to your sense of self to do, and I think takes a lot of courage. That we realize it's kind of clear from the outset that people who, you know, leave their towns for the first time to take buses across the country to protest in the capital city of Brazil are doing something really courageous. I think what I didn't realize until we had started doing this research and talked to these women over time is that trying to change what dynamics look like in your household and trying to make a space for women to speak at the dinner table and to play a role in decisions about the family's finances, that's equally, if not more, courageous and hard to do.
And I would also add that we're talking about two different but overlapping historical periods. That in the 80s, there was a real sense of freedom and a kind of grassroots organizing that young people were doing all over Brazil and Brazil South. But it was a really dangerous moment because generals were running the country and it was hard to speak out. People who'd spoken out before you had been imprisoned or tortured, but it seemed like a tipping point was happening. So the people were gathering, coming up with new strategies, challenging in new ways. That was always dangerous. Jessie Bonnes, one of the most sort of charismatic and powerful of the women's movement leaders whom we met, told us what it's like to stand up to the police. You're moving forward with a demonstration of women. The police are stepping back, but you don't know. Should you keep moving forward? Will they attack you? Will they shoot you? Will they launch tear gas at you? So you kind of, she said, we look at the women. Are we ready? Are we together? And we'd go forward. So in the early years, that's where the battle was. But as dictatorship gave way to democracy, and women were able to make that democracy deliver on economic rights for women, on legal rights for women, that's when the kinds of issues that Emma pointed to really came to the fore. That the issues of gender, the issues of being a woman with equal rights who then acts to use those rights in her family and community, that was much harder than anyone ever expected.
Now, this woman whom you just referred to, Jessie Bonnes, she is such an interesting character. She was clearly a leader from the earliest age, just in the way her personality was. And her path was through the priests and nuns, who were really the first people to listen to her concerns. And they were practicing a kind of liberation theology, which was compatible with the politics of the times. But when she tried to go into the convent, it didn't really work out very well.
Yes, so Jessie talks about many different moments in her life when she tried to figure out kind of where and how she could fight for the change she wanted to create in her community and in the world. And that desire to create change came in part from growing up under dictatorship and taking part in efforts to overthrow the military, and also from her experience in church youth groups with priests and nuns who were committed to developing her sense of what was going on in the community around her and really showing Jessie and other young people at this time that they could play a role in making change. And Jessie said that when she was a teenager, she thought, well, a lot of the people I know who are most committed to social change are priests and nuns, so I'll become a nun. And that idea did not last long. She was not happy at the convent, where she felt that the kind of principles of dignity and voice and paying attention to social justice and other issues were not kind of what was being taught, that she was studying religious texts but without an eye towards the issues that she cared about most. And she actually wanted to quit after a couple of months, and she went home for a break and told her dad, from whom she inherited her wit and also her commitment and dedication to sticking things out over time. And her father said, you can quit at the end of the year, but you have to go back. And Jessie actually says that it was that experience of finishing off the year somewhere where what was going on didn't align with her values that motivated her to return to her town to continue organizing and to work to found a women's movement where she'd be working with people who shared her values and shared her commitment to making change.
Now, the women's movement kind of sprung from the land rights movement, or it was happening around that same time. Tell us first about the land rights movement in rural southern Brazil.
People who worked on small farms in rural southern Brazil had really experienced a difficult economic time during the military dictatorship, because in addition to stifling political rights, the military was really promoting a model of agricultural change and modernization that we're familiar with in other parts of the world. So to promote large-scale farming, promote corporate agriculture, basically push people off the land so that they go to the cities, where we know now people often don't find work and live in situations of poverty. So in this region, people didn't want that to happen, and they didn't want to leave and go to the cities. So they developed ways of resisting that aspect of the military's policy, significantly by working to make the local farmers' unions in their towns more responsive to local farmers and less responsive to the military. And as that proceeded, another group of people who didn't have land started forming a movement to make claims to land, to say the distribution of land in this country, Brazil, is so unequal that we need to start taking land that isn't being used and distributing that to people who need it. So the women we got to know, they came of age along with the young men in their towns, joining these movements, encouraged by the priests, and really developing a way of thinking, how could the world be different? We're fighting a military dictatorship. We're fighting the kind of impoverishment that we're suffering on our family farms. How can we envision a political life and an economic life in our towns that will look different, that will promote decent living standards for people, that will let them stay on their land? And as they did this, and this was something that happened in the U.S. women's movement in the 60s and 70s, they began to see that when they voiced women's concerns, the men around them said, oh, that may be important, but that's not the fight we're fighting now. We have to fight for land, or there's a dam being built that's going to inundate our town. We need to fight for that. We'll fight for the women's issues later. And these young women in their teens and early 20s said gradually, we're not going to fight for that later. We need to fight for that now. And in order to do that, it looks like we're going to need to start our own movement. And many of the men who worked with them said, oh, don't do that. You'll weaken the land-based movement. You'll weaken the farmers' union. And they said, no, we won't. We'll do both of those things together, but we need a movement that will help us from the get-go address women's concerns and how being a woman and wanting voice as a woman is connected to trying to create a fairer world for everyone.
And the priests and nuns who had originally brought these teenagers into activism, who had kind of gone door-to-door in rural communities and convinced parents that it was okay for their kids to be involved, they actually supported these women at the beginning of the women's movement in starting their own movement and in working, as my dad said, to balance economic and gender issues at the same time.
The priests and nuns were really crucial in this region. And if we look at Brazil broadly, Brazil has progressed from being a military dictatorship to being a thriving democracy. The activist liberation theology priests and nuns on the ground in the places like southern Brazil in the 70s and 80s, they were among the first people to realize how unjust the system was and to really stimulate and empower people to fight back. So they're an important part of the story as well.
We're talking to Jeff Rubin and Emma Sokolov Rubin about the book Sustaining Activism, a Brazilian Women's Movement and a Father-Daughter Collaboration. I think one of the things that's so interesting about this question is, like, should I fight against the corporate agriculture and the dam and the oppression, all that, versus should we fight for our rights as a woman, is that, as you point out in the book, the latter, the women's movement, was really about changing fundamental values, because it was about changing the roles of what people did. Whereas land distribution, while very, very important, and also, I mean, changes the structure, the sort of economic structure, really doesn't change that much how people lived on a day-to-day basis.
Well, I think you're right that when you're trying to change families, that you're kind of deeply destabilizing and shaking up how things work in these towns. So the women's movement and women's experience in the movement led them to take all sorts of different directions with their lives. I think once they saw that they could change things, but it was possible, even in places you knew really well, even in places where everyone knew each other, to try to change things. One example of that is Ivani and Vanya, two women who met leading the women's movement, and they ended up moving in together as a couple and living together in one of these small Catholic towns. And one of many things that's really interesting about their story is that they said that it was their experience leading the women's movement, that their experience of seeing that kind of an alternative was possible, that it was possible to create alternatives politically and socially, that led them to take a chance on an alternative lifestyle themselves, and a lifestyle that was very out of the ordinary for the communities they lived in. And that it was their experience in their relationship that led them to stick with the women's movement over time. But one of the things they later found was that even in this movement, which they had helped found with the goal of giving women a space to speak about themselves, the topic of homosexuality and these two women's relationship wasn't something that other people were comfortable talking about. And even though Ivani and Vanya repeatedly brought up the topic for women's movement newsletters and repeatedly tried to start conversations in their own families, while they never experienced, you know, no one was ever mean to them, no one ever told them to be quiet, they participated in the social life of their town and of the women's movement, they were always met with silence when they tried to talk about this topic. And that was a big challenge for them over time, that the very space they had created as an open space for conversation wasn't open to them in so many ways.
And what I think this story shows, as you said, Mary Charlotte, is that these women realized from the get-go that the big political questions played out in their daily lives, and they had to make change in both of those areas. People told us repeatedly, this is about dialogue. This is about learning to speak as equals in our families and in politics and in making decisions as equals. It's also about learning how to live our daily life and live the difficulties and the inequalities in our daily life. We have a vision of what should be better, and we have a daily life that's filled with constraints, and we have to find a way of sustaining each other in that daily life and through it. So we need dialogue, we need ways of talking as equals, and we need a way of living through and creating sort of set kinds of solidarity and kinds of ways of being together and being public. And that really is the backstory of what made for big political changes in Brazil and gender changes in this town.
And I have to say, I mean, the kinds of struggles, internal and external, that you're writing about in this book are so universal. They may have been a different era of the United States history or German history or whatever country you want to look at, but we all seem to go through a similar trajectory and face similar struggles. I mean, one of the things that struck me about the women's movement there was a lot of these women really wanted to go to meetings and organize and were very clear about what they wanted to do, but they had to ask permission to even leave the house from either their fathers or their husbands, and they developed all of these strategies of ways to leave that, like they do a whole bunch of extra housework and then just say, oh, I gotta go right now, I'll be back soon. And they had to lie. And just that kind of constraint on what you are allowed to do as an adult is something that, I mean, I was reading it going, boy, I'm glad I never had to do that. Although I suppose in our teenage years, that was an issue for every girl, even here.
Right. And I think that the experience of, as teenagers, of having to ask permission from their fathers to leave the house, but even more of watching their mothers ask permission to leave the house, is what motivated many of these young women to start a movement. You know, one of the things that engaged me from the very beginning was the question of, so how did this happen? How did young women come to see themselves as activists? And how did they take a chance on founding a movement that so many of their families insisted would fail? And I think many of the women brought us back to that moment, saying, you know, Vera, one of the young leaders of the women's movement, she said, you know, I would always ask my mom, why don't you speak at home? Why do you ask permission to leave the house? And her mom said, it's because it's always been this way. And one important thing to note is that these women could have focused their efforts on trying to leave. The young woman who started the movement could have said, we're going to get out of here. We're going to move to cities. We're going to leave our families. And instead, they wanted to stay. They wanted to continue working on the farms where they grew up. They wanted to contribute to the life of their communities, but they felt that they couldn't possibly stay under the circumstances in which they grew up. So they were trying to change their own lives, their own futures, and the lives of their mothers. And as a young woman, that was one of the things that immediately drew me in, was hearing these women talk about the injustice they had seen as teenagers and the changes they were trying to make and the changing landscape of family dynamics in their communities over time.
And I think that's where they may have started off with a degree of constraint that's unfamiliar to us in the United States, but I think that where they are now is very familiar to us, and certainly very familiar to me as a family member struggling with the idea of what does it mean to have equal gender roles in the United States today? What does it mean to balance work and home? I felt like the women we were getting to know who were largely in marriages with men who were willing to see their wives work and go out, but had kinds of ambivalences about that, to see them really try to hammer out, what does it mean to be equal? What does it mean to have voice? What does it mean to bring up your male and female children, the boys and girls in your family, to think of themselves as equal and to have possibilities of moving forward? Those are really complicated issues. That's what's hard for the women we got to know, and I think that's hard for people in the United States today as well. Challenging, exciting. We see changes and we don't see changes. It's a complicated place that I think people in many countries are grappling with.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's much harder in a farming community where there are gender roles, probably for some good reasons that have to do with the differences in our bodies and things like that. But I think the really fundamental question that we're all looking at is, should gender roles be separated, or should we be doing pretty much all of our different professions together? You know, should all scientists and nurses and doctors and basically every profession, and including work at home, be completely integrated? And I don't think we've come to any consensus as a society almost anywhere on that topic.
We talked about that. I talked about with Vera, who became the first woman union president in her town. You know, major historic role. She had started in the women's movement and then moved into another kind of activism. And I said, you know, are you fighting for men and women to be completely equal? And she said, oh, no, that's not what we're fighting for. We're fighting for a kind of mutual respect among people who might have different roles. Well, that was true, but she was also fiercely taking a brand new role for women and saying, I'm going to be a woman in this male job of union president. So she was actively debating that. And another way to think about that is how you define work. You talked about work on a farm being gendered. We talked to a woman named Monica Marchesini, who milked the cows every day on her farm and took that milk and made cheese out of it and made products to sell. And we asked her, what do you think about when you're milking the cow? It's one of those interview questions that just comes to you and you don't even know if it's a useful question. And she said, well, I'm milking the cow, I'm thinking that I'm producing income for my family and doing an economic activity that contributes to our family economy. Well, that was 20 years of work of the women's movement. Monica didn't say, I'm doing women's work, I'm doing what my mother did, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. She immediately equated her work with what her husband does, gave it an economic value, and talked about how important it is. So that's another way in which being on a farm, you've got the same issues, and it's how you talk about them and how you reconfigure them and whether there's dialogue about them.
But at the same time, her husband was a completely annoying drunk who would come in and watch television, put his feet all over the table, and she was working from 6 in the morning until midnight, and he worked an 8-hour day.
Yeah, and you know, as a researcher there, it was often really hard to make sense of what's going on. You know, when Monica's standing at the sink doing dishes, and her husband's sitting on the couch, and Monica's saying, you know, men need to help with the dishes, everybody makes a mess, everyone needs to help clean up, we are all equals in this family, but she's the one doing the dishes, and he's hanging out on the couch, and she says, you know, everybody gets tired, but at the end of the day, I need to do the housework, and he needs to watch TV. My first reaction was, well, then what's changed? What's happening here? How is this any different from what these women describe happening with their parents? But then I realized that she was standing there saying those things, and her husband was listening to her. Her husband was listening to it, and she was comfortable saying those things. She leaves her women's movement meetings. She kind of owns that perspective and belief that things should change. And I realized that Monica was able in that moment and in so many other moments to hold her vision of what she wants the world to look like, hold the vision she discusses at women's movement meetings of the kind of gender dynamics she wants to see in families, the kind of rights she wants women to have. She's able to hold that alongside the daily reality, which often doesn't look that way. Or if it does, it's only in very small ways and very slowly over time. So we talk about that as holding paradox. She's able to hold the vision of what she wants the world to look like at the same time as living the reality that she lives. And in fact, for Monica, that motivates her. That drives her forward because she each day is seeing what she's fighting against and what she's fighting for. And that both keeps her committed to the vision of change at the women's movement, and it also keeps her committed to putting her all into the daily reality she lives, into the trying to change it, and also into going about the tasks she does each day, thinking about what they should be, thinking about what they are, and engaging deeply with the vision of the women's movement and with her daily life.
Well, I couldn't help wondering how her sons and daughters would grow up having witnessed what they witnessed.
I think that is a great question. It's one of the reasons I'm really excited to continue visiting these communities over time to see how things play out, because that is certainly one of the big reasons these women started the movement, was so that their children's lives would look different from their own. And just from observing these couples as parents, it certainly seems like their children are growing up in very different families than their parents did. But it'll be really interesting to go back and see over time. And even as, you know, we have completed one major stage of this project, which is publishing a book about our work, we're certainly excited to continue going back and forth to Brazil over time, both to bring the book back to women and to see how the communities change over time and what their children's lives look like.
And the children are growing up before our eyes, so we're just beginning to get a sense of who they are. If we go back after a couple of years, we say, look, that's Natalia, that's Mitali. This person is becoming a young woman, and what kind of choices is she making? Where is she going to school? And inevitably, they have a kind of sense of themselves and presence that we're both surprised at because they're older. You don't see that in little kids. And then we realize that we're perhaps seeing a part of their mother in them, sort of a
right.
way of
There's moments where it's like, of course, this is Jesse's daughter. And I'm, you know, Jesse's daughter is almost the age that Jesse was when she started the women's movement. So I'm really excited to engage in some of the conversations we had with Jesse, now with her daughter. And I would say that I think the same thing is happening on their end, in the sense that we're watching their kids grow up, but they've also watched me grow up. This project started when I was, I first met them when I was 12, and the research project started when I was 15. I'm now 23. And we've gone back every couple of years as often as we could. And while, you know, we've been doing research on what they're doing, I think they've always been engaged in conversation with us. And so I would imagine that they're also thinking some of the things we are about, you know, how exciting it is to watch people change and watch the decisions they make over time.
We're talking to Jeff Rubin and Emma Sokolov-Rubin about their book, Sustaining Activism, a Brazilian Women's Movement and a Father-Daughter Collaboration. Another component of the women's movement was teaching women, educating women about birth control and women's bodies and sexuality and things like that. Now, how did that go? I guess there was some resistance from the men in their lives, again, over this component of their education.
I think that's true. I think that one of the things the movement did was raise topics that weren't usually talked about. That was one of the most important things that happened in the space that Women's Movement Meeting created. You know, in addition to planning strategies for major mobilizations and for gaining rights, they had conversations that women often weren't having at home, often weren't, you know, learning things they weren't often learning about from their mothers. But yes, that was complicated. It was complicated with the church. It was complicated with many of the men in their lives. And, you know, I think that happens when people are really on the front lines of a movement, on the front lines of provoking new conversations.
Do you know, there were a number of pathways that women found in the women's movement to deal with that. One is that they were in touch with an advisory group of women's activists and feminists in Porto Alegre, the capital city of the state they lived in. And they learned a lot about new ways of thinking about women's health and what it would mean to think differently about their bodies, about healthcare and sexuality in dialogue with those advisors. Always, I think, it was always impressive to us that the women in the countryside, they controlled their movement. So they would seek help from the priests. They would seek help from feminist advisors. They would make alliances with the land-based movement. But they were in control of what they were doing. The other thing that happened is there was a big change in the constitutional provisions for healthcare in Brazil. And healthcare for all was made part of the national constitution. Now, that's far from being carried out in reality, but they began a series of political mobilizations as well as educational and organizing efforts to begin to think about what it would mean to have access to healthcare when you went to your doctor's office and what it would mean to think about birth control or abortion in those contexts. And I was astonished to be in a church meeting room hearing women talk very frankly about these kinds of issues. And finally, they really invented a new form of activity, which they called women's pharmacies. And these were places where women both learned about the herbal remedies and kinds of care that they could learn from their mothers and grandmothers, sort of through a very women-based tradition. And they also began discussions about sexuality and about violence against women. They formed a space where women could trust each other and where they could begin to speak about the things that were most difficult, and not just speak, but begin to analyze them, begin to think about, what does this mean? Why is this happening? How can we think about it differently? And we were really bowled over that women in the countryside with fairly minimal educations really managed in a very sophisticated way to make use of these different possibilities around them and to create their own sort of new, innovative kind of space, these women's pharmacies, that many different women with many different approaches in the movement could learn from and engage in these very sort of sensitive and important discussions in.
You, Jeff, have seen and written about various Latin American political movements. To what extent did people, well, first of all, from different parts of Brazil, which is a vast country, and then from different parts of Latin America, to what extent were they communicating with each other and learning from each other as these movements were going on? Because there was military dictatorships all over Latin America.
I think that there's enormous interchange across Latin America. I think the possibility for women to become activists was something that traveled from Argentina and the Mothers of the Disappeared to women in popular movements in Mexico to women in southern Brazil. These women were never isolated. Back in the 80s, there wasn't the internet, there wasn't that immediate flow of information, but texts and articles and kind of talks and people were moving around. And I think the notion that women could play a particular role in fighting for social change and in fighting for their own rights was something that they learned from elsewhere. I think they also learned this notion of grassroots struggle and standing up to the military. That was something happening in many different places, that there was a political battle to overthrow the military, and also that movements in Mexico, Indian movements in southern Mexico, movements in Chile against Pinochet, that all these movements were coming up with unconventional strategies to fight power, and that they were beginning to envision what a more socially just world might look like at that moment. And the other thing that's been amazing for me as a student of these movements to watch is what it means to wield authority and create forms of decision-making within a movement. And I think in the early years against dictatorships, there was a certain notion among movements that would call themselves leftist movements in Latin America that in order to fight these kinds of power, you needed to have a centralized movement with a hierarchy. You needed to be able to make decisions quickly and tell everyone in the movement what the decisions were. And it was often male leaders at the center of a national movement who were making those decisions. And I think one of the things that women's activism did, as well as indigenous activism and other forms of activism by people who hadn't been at the center of those battles, was to say, wait a minute, we want to think about movements for struggle and change, movements on the left in Latin America, that are also movements that create space for many different voices and allow people with different views to find a way to form one movement together. So it's a really big shift from a social movement being something that wields power by being centralized, hierarchical, and making decisions strategically, to a movement as being something that stays powerful over the long haul by enabling many groups of people to kind of come together, battle it out, argue, you know, figure out what to do next, but recognize that there are going to be differences among them.
On a really fundamental level, one of the things that I think about when you are talking about that is that a military dictatorship is a male-centered, hierarchical, centralized movement, and to fight it with something that is also that may not be the best idea, because as we've seen, there are really wonderful social and political movements that have turned into their own dictatorships. And in a way, having women and having different voices and having indigenous voices and all of those things together create a fundamentally different kind of power structure in the first place that perhaps has a better chance of making real social change and ultimately a peaceful society.
And I think what you're talking about is democratic citizenship. Brazil and other Latin American countries have been democracies, most of them, since the 1980s. But then there's a real question, what does it mean to be a democracy? Just what you're saying, does it actually change fundamental things? Does democracy bring voice to many different people in society who've been excluded? Does it create the kinds of economic reforms that enable people to live decent lives? And that's a really big question at play in Latin America today. Now that Latin American countries are democratic, are they going to become better better societies and fairer societies? Or will democracy just be a form of kind of politics at the national level that's way better than military rule but isn't really making deep changes? And I think what you've just described, bringing multiple voices into political movements and struggling, as the women did, with how do you make a space for dialogue within movements and multiple voices, and then how do you create multiple ways of being political and pressing the national government to change, that's really the hope for democracy. And at the national level in Brazil, we can see that with the election of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, or Lula, the first Workers' Party president. He was a union leader with a grade school education. He was elected in 2002, and now Brazil has its first female president, who had been a leftist guerrilla against the military and is now really committed to bringing about significant kinds of social reform in Brazil. So I think you're absolutely right that a move to movements that allow women, indigenous people, Afro-Brazilians to participate and that are committed to a different model of authority in politics has before our eyes in Brazil translated to a national democracy that is grappling with really important questions. And it matters to be able to grapple with those questions if we're going to see a peaceful and more just future in Latin America.
And I have to say, the way you're talking, if you took out Latin America and Brazil and put in United States of America, it's almost the exact same thing. I mean, we have this, okay, it's not a military dictatorship going on at the national level, but we certainly are not, so many of us feel like we're not really represented by the politics going on in Washington. We also, like Brazil, have tremendous, terrible inequality here. We have the problem that they have there of agribusiness and pesticides and people being poisoned by these pesticides, and you write about that in the book, and it's basically, it's the same kind of struggles.
I think we certainly have a lot to learn from these women and from many Brazilians who participate in social movements about the role that social movements play in a democracy and the essential role that social movements play, that even, as my dad was saying, even when there's a democracy, it's essential to have movements out there fighting for specific issues, fighting to lessen inequality and fighting to improve people's rights in the long run, you know, to both to deal with immediate problems and issues and also to fight for a more equal society long term.
And I think you're on to one of the other things that drew us to be so interested in seeing what these women in southern Brazil were doing and to learning from them. They wanted to make the society around them more just. They always put women's rights and equal gender roles front and center, but they always kept all the other issues of environment, of economy, of political voice in view. And they were figuring out on the ground, just like they were figuring out gender roles, Jessi Bonesses' issue. Do you work in the government or should you be out there in the streets protesting? Where do you make effective change? They never, in a good way, they never resolved that issue. They were making it productive. And I think that's what we think about, as you just suggested, when we look at movements for change in the United States. There's this conviction that we have that you need movements in the streets that are acting creatively to bring people together, to put issues on the table, and to press government to make change, just as you also need people in government who have a vision of change and are looking for ways to institute that. And it's really exciting to us that Brazil at this moment can be a lesson for us and a lesson for the world. Not to say that there's a perfect solution in Brazil, it's really complicated, but there's a real kind of transnational political learning and example giving going on that's really exciting to watch.
I also want to expand upon one of the stories my dad just brought up of Jessi Bonesses, a leader we've been talking about throughout our conversation today. After leading the women's movement for 15 years and really being seen as this militant leader willing to protest anywhere, you know, who really saw protests in the streets as a way to make change, in 2001, kind of as Brazilian politics shifted, she was offered the position of head of the health department in her small town of 7,000. And she faced a really tough decision. My dad alluded to this. You know, do you continue to fight for change in the streets, or do you begin to work in the institutions with the resources and power and also the limitations of bureaucracy that that brings? And she ended up deciding to try out the health department to take this position. She had a fifth grade education. She had had to quit school after fifth grade to help with the housework. She had no medical training. And she really took that health department by storm. And as we were talking about earlier about bringing local voices into politics, one of the things she did, in addition to opening a 24-hour emergency room in her town, was to train local women as community health workers to go door to door and show people in the community that they had access to health care, that their voices could also be heard in the government there. Even as Jessie transform the health department, even as she convinced her colleagues in the department that you didn't need a background in politics to be able to transform a health department, to be able to bring a really important voice into local government. She continued to struggle with the question of when you know you really want to make change, and there's more than one option available to you for how to do that, when you could fight in a women's movement or you could work from the government. How do you do that? What kinds of choices do you make? And I wanted to say that Jessie's story, we've written a short profile of her on our, a longer profile of her in the book, but a short profile on our website. And there are also profiles of several of the other women we've talked about today, of Monica and of Ivani and Vanya. So if listeners are interested in hearing more about these women's stories, the website is sustainingactivism.com. And in addition to more information about the book, listeners can find profiles of several different women and the kinds of decisions that they have made and faced on that site.
So we're talking about the book Sustaining Activism, a Brazilian Women's Movement and a Father-Daughter Collaboration with Jeff Rubin and Emma Sokolov Rubin. How's Brazil doing today? I mean, the military dictatorship is over. All these social change movements have happened and are still happening, but there's still tremendous inequality and poor land distribution and things like that, and we read about deforestation and whatnot. How would you evaluate how Brazil is doing today?
Brazil is facing a lot of really tough issues, and there's multiple ways that one has to look at it. One is the changes that have happened over the last 25 years are truly astonishing. No one would have predicted when the country was being ruled by the military in the 1980s that Brazil would be run by a woman from the Workers' Party in a thriving democracy with among the fairest elections in the world, and that democracy would also be thriving economically. So that's a success story. At the same time, Brazil is one of the most unequal countries in the world. The issues and problems of unequal development and of favoring of corporate agriculture and of large-scale industry that I talked about earlier, those haven't been solved. Development is unequal. There are shanty towns surrounding the major cities of Rio and São Paulo. There are landless people in the countryside. There are very high levels of violence, both drug-related violence and crime-related violence. Those are really hard issues to deal with. I think what's in place now is a government that will say, we want to grow the economy so as to make poor people better off and make our country fairer. They're not saying we're going to grow the economy and it's going to trickle down. They're saying our economic policies need to be preoccupied primarily with improving people's lives. But how to do that today in the globalized world is really hard. There are outside economic institutions, outside powers who are saying the only way to keep growing is to use the old economic model. And investors will only invest in Brazil if corporate agriculture grows, if mining grows, if major exports of mineral products and agricultural products to the rest of the world happen on the most efficient terms. So we're not living in a world that says, how do you improve the economy in a way that's a market-based economy, but in fact pays attention to employing more people, giving them decent wages, and enabling them to participate in a growing market. So those problems are just out there. The Olympics and the World Soccer Cup are coming to Brazil in the coming years. Those are big moments of success, but they're coming to cities with lots of poverty and lots of inequality. And what we found on the ground in southern Brazil is that the kind of movements that we were studying, we believe, and the activists we talked to believe, are necessary to have out there, pressuring, offering visions for change, and really pushing government to make changes. So even though there's a leftist woman in office, she needs movements out there in the streets, movements fighting for social change to help her do her job. And in fact, Dilma Rousseff, the current president of Brazil, met with leaders of the rural women's movement last month to talk about issues of domestic violence and how those could be dealt with at the national level as well as the local level. So there needs to be this constant back and forth between people organizing movements and pressing on government, working in the institutions and in the streets, and national-level processes of change that need to really stand up to international constraints and international economic and political ways of doing business and saying, no, we need new ways of doing this in Brazil for the 21st century.
So they're facing the same problems that everybody is facing, namely, how do you have the benefits of an industrial society without having the total corporate domination? And this plays out, of course, on a rural level, with the kind of Monsantos and pesticides and people edging out the smaller organic farmers and the smaller organic farmers saying, wait a minute, what we do is healthy and sustainable. And that's happening in southern Brazil as it's happening in New Mexico, as it's happening all around the world.
It's happening in all those places. And this is, I think we need to look to Brazil right now because it's like the best chance around. Brazil has come so far, there's so much still to grapple with. If these problems could be grappled with some success on the ground through this democratic and activist process in Brazil, I think it really offers hope for other parts of the world. Latin America today and Brazil is a place without extensive terrorism of any sort, without religious fundamentalism, without extensive political repression. They're places with the really enduring problems that you just outlined. How to create economically just societies and get economies to grow to include people. There isn't that other stuff, but there's that big problem which we've inherited from the 20th century. How do you create greater equality? How do you bring people in? How do you rein in forces of corporate profits and of globalizing economic processes? So I think that's why eyes are on Brazil, because it matters to all of us whether headway can be made here or not.
And meanwhile, the two of you are engaged in this now long-term father-daughter collaboration that you never really saw coming. And I thought one of the really interesting questions that Emma brought up when the two of you were in Brazil, and she was a really young woman finding her way in this whole question of research and studying women's movements, was you asked Emma, when are you supposed to be yourself and share your own life, even as you're supposed to be the observer? And I think that's a profound question.
I agree, and it's a question I'm still asking. I think I gain bits of insight as I go, but it's a question in some ways that I hope I continue asking throughout my whole career, because I think that it's an important one to have in mind at each step of the way doing research. I think that going and doing research together made us more real to the people we were getting to know, that they were bringing us into their families, into their kitchens, onto their farms. You know, our research wasn't done in coffee shops or office building. Our research was done on farms and kitchens, in church basements, at meetings. And I think that going there as a father-daughter team, you know, it meant that both of us were bringing a little bit of our reality from home with us. And I think that the experience of watching us work together, I would imagine, was a bittersweet one for leaders of this movement who at first had to defy their fathers in order to start a movement, although later their fathers came around and began supporting their activism.
And I would also add that the same issues were really profound for me as a professor and as someone who does scholarly research, that we have an image of research where the objective researcher goes out by him or herself to find out something from a part of the world that we want to know about. That's the professional part of ourselves. What I did kind of unexpectedly was bring my personal life with me into my professional research. And initially, it was this thing I was doing on the side. It was not my main research project. It was the research project I was doing with Emma. And then, over time, I realized this was my research. This is a different model for doing research. The professor or the researcher or the academic is much more a mixture of professional and personal, and the university isn't so far from daily life. We were bringing information back and forth from our research and Boston University, where I teach, to the rural women. We were bringing them back our ideas. We were bringing their ideas back here. We were also bringing our work from Boston University into the community around us here and around the countryside in Brazil. So what I found was my way of thinking of research changed dramatically in the course of this project.
And this project also made me a really big believer in collaboration. That's not to say that every research project, you know, needs to or even should be done collaboratively, but there's something really exciting about having two people out in the field together so that both of your questions are shaping the way a conversation goes. You know, there were times when we'd be doing an interview where my dad would ask a question, and sometimes I didn't even think it was a good question at first, and then it would lead to such an interesting insight, or he would ask a great question, and I would think about, oh, how can I follow up on that? What comes next? And in some ways, it's tricky collaborating, because you never know what the other person is going to ask or going to say, or which direction they'll, you know, push a conversation in. And so learning how to bounce off each other, bounce ideas off each other, and also bounce ideas off the people we were interviewing is one of the ways that I think we were kind of, I guess as I put it in that sentence you quoted it, real people, even as we were also observers.
And I think what else Emma's also indicating is that what we were doing was about dialogue, and what the women were doing in their movement was about dialogue. And there were moments when we realized that in a small way, we were trying to create new forms of voice and dialogue in academic research and in our family, and the women were working really hard to create new forms of dialogue and living in their towns. And those were kind of parallel processes in a really exciting way.
Yeah, yeah. Jeffrey Rubin is a professor of history at Boston University. Emma Sokolov-Rubin is a journalist and reporter for Gotham Schools in New York City. They are co-authors of the book Sustaining Activism, a Brazilian Women's Movement and a Father-Daughter Collaboration. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us. Thank you for your great questions.
Thanks for having us. We really enjoyed it.